Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Pulses. What are they? They're the edible seeds of legumes, and we know them as beans, lentils, and peas. They've been around a long time, and yet, suddenly, they're all over the news and all over the food blogs. We'll find out why, and we'll find out all about them today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And indeed, pulses, or peas, legumes, lentils, beans, they've been around for, I'm not even sure, so I've called in an expert. And indeed, they are an important part of the diet millennia ago, and they are still, again, today, and always have been. What I've done is called on one of my go-to resources for all things medieval Mediterranean, Clifford Wright. And then later in the show, I have somebody who's going to tell us about the importance today and what's happening today with pulses, because whether you know it or not, 2016 is the International Year of Pulses, organized by the UN. And Tim McGreevy, the CEO of the Dried Pea and Lentil Council, will be with us later in the show to tell us what's happening today with pulses. But first of all, I want to know all about the history of pulses, or as much as we can find out. And Clifford, are you there?
I'm right here.
Thanks for joining me today, Clifford. As I say, you are my go-to source for all things medieval and Mediterranean,
Happy to hear that.
And I know that archaeologists have, you know, discovered traces back many, many years, but there's also other evidences in the human diet. Tell me a little bit about pulses.
Well, the interesting thing about a pulse, and just for the audience to know, the definition of a pulse is just simply the edible seeds of the various crops that make up the legume family, peas, beans, lentils, and so forth. They are certainly some of the oldest cultivated plants known to humans. So the very earliest agriculture, which has been dated to somewhere between 13,000 and 9,000 years ago, have found lentils, for example, for sure. A little bit later, you find peas. But with that being said, it should be understood that the whole concept and the question of lentil domestication and the domestication and cultivation of pulses is still vigorously debated in the academic community. So we don't have any set conclusions as to its origins and so forth. Mm. But that doesn't stop them being nutritious and delicious. So
right.
That's a good thing.
Well, when I said you're my go-to source for medieval Mediterranean foods, and obviously you have done some research on this, and then I did not go on to read your bio, because I think it is important to do so. Clifford Wright is a culinary historian and contributing editor to Zester Daily, and he's the author of 16 books, 14 of which are cookbooks, and the winner of the James Beard Cookbook of the Year and Beard Award for the Best Writing for A Mediterranean Feast, a giant tome of wonderful information and recipes, and that was back in 2000. And your articles, Clifford, I know, have appeared in Gourmet and Bon Appetit, Food and Wine, and so forth, as well as some other academic journals on when it comes to research on medieval Mediterranean foods. So, whereabouts can you tell us that some of the discoveries of these pulses were made early on?
It's basically, in terms of the cultivation of them, it's basically the Middle East. It's all about the Middle East. So the earliest dating for lentils that we have is from a cave in Greece from about 13,000 years ago. So we're talking about Paleolithic era.
Wow.
And then there are some other sites in Syria and the Jericho area around 8,000 BC. And then in Turkey, there's a site where they have found lentils from 7,000 BC. So they're basically associated with old world agricultural revolution, prehistoric times. And the interesting thing is that lentils are often found to be domesticated along with einkorn and emmer, which are two kinds of species of wheat, and barley and peas and flax. So it gives an indication of what agriculture looked like at that time.
Huh. And you are always referring to lentils. Were other types of peas, ground peas or beans found at that time?
Yeah, you know, the thing with beans is, first of all, when you talk about beans, you need to distinguish between old world and new world beans. So
right.
The bean, when we talk about beans, like the beans that go into to a bean salad, let's say, those are new world beans, known as Phaseolus vulgaris in the language of scientists. And those new world beans moved to the old world not before 1492, in other words, not before Columbus discovered America. The old world beans, such as fava bean or hyacinth bean, lentils, and the various other ones like peas, those have an older history. As far as the new world, now, today, old world beans exist in the new world, and new world beans exist in the old world, so it's all mixed up. But generally, when we think of legumes, we think of things like lentils and peas, and there are many others that are more used in Indian cuisine, for example, the peas that are in legumes known as gram, black gram, red gram, and they have a variety of different names that are not too popular in the Mediterranean, or for that matter in this country, but are very popular in South Asia.
Hmm. And chickpeas, too. I always think of chickpeas
and
as
chickpeas,
a... Yeah.
Chickpeas would be included in that category as well. That's right.
Right. And when you say the Middle East, of course, you know, it's no surprise because so many of the recipes that we know and that we rely upon do have that Middle Eastern flavor or are of Middle Eastern origin. And, of course, hummus, which is all over the place today. I mean, who would have ever thought, right? It's been around forever.
It certainly has. And there's been so many examples of those kinds of dishes that are just famous around the world now, but they basically come from the Mediterranean. You mentioned one being hummus. But just think of every single bean soup in Italy you may have eaten. I mean, all those examples are fava beans, or if you were in Egypt, you'd be eating fava bean mash and so forth. As far as the other kinds of legumes, in India, you have all the dals, which are made from a variety of different legumes. So they're real nutrient-rich foods that have been sustaining populations for a long time.
All right. I mean, we know even from written evidence, lentils appear in the Bible, and they also appear in some ancient Roman writings.
Absolutely. I mean, the famous one is in Genesis, the story of how Esau gives up his birthright for a dish of lentils. And we know that the ancient Greeks enjoyed lentils. There's a great little comment by Aristophanes in one of his plays where he says to another person, "You who dare insult lentil soup, the sweetest of delicacies." So we know that the Greeks loved lentils. They also made it into bread. Then by the time of the Romans, you've got Roman writers talking about lentil dishes being eaten by the poor people. And then in Apicius, the first century Roman cookbook author, he's got many recipes for lentils. So we know they're being eaten in a variety of ways.
Yeah, and interesting because some of those early Roman recipes are not terribly unlike how we consume them today.
Absolutely. I mean, they tend to be kind of simple. I mean, there's a little sprinkling of olive oil and maybe some coriander and salt, and very, very similar.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the lentil, making bread out of it. How often, or do we know, were these legumes ground into a flour?
Well, we know that we don't know how often, but we know when.
Not often,
basically,
but when.
In times of famine. So when wheat was suffering, inferior grains were used, such as millet or barley, to be used into bread making, and these are considered to be inferior breads as well. And when it was really bad times, then dried legumes would be ground up and made into bread. But when you say bread, don't think of some nice fluffy baguette.
Right.
We're talking about some pretty hard stuff. But it was food, and that's all that counted in times of famine. And then in really bad times, they'd grind up nuts and acorns and sometimes mix it with wood. So it was a desperate situation.
That's been in the news recently, too. Totally different story. Totally different story. You know, it's interesting because when you said in times of famine, and lentils, different types of legumes, have for a long time been associated with foods of the poor.
This is true.
And interesting because they have made such a comeback, particularly for people who have chosen to have a vegetarian diet and replace, you know, the meat with lentils, knowing that we know that they have a high source of protein. Lentil cakes, lentil burgers, you know, anyone who's ever had a lentil chip, you got to know it's a really tasty thing.
Well, lentils are tasty. There's no doubt about it.
All right. And the hummus industry is certainly something that leads you away from thinking that it's, you know, food of the poor. But then, of course, it's one of the greatest street food, snack foods throughout the Middle East. In Israel and places in the Middle East, falafel. I mean, what a terrific treat that is. And that's,
yeah, it's a great little invention. These are kind of, if you will, value-added foods, where you take these basic ingredients and you turn them into a new food. So falafel being a new food, hummus being a new food, and so forth. And that's what really cuisine is all about, is the transformation of these raw foods into cooked foods in a way of cooking them so that they are reproducible by a society, by a civilization.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's no surprise that they were grown throughout that region. I mean, they are, you know, today a very important crop, which we're going to hear more about later. But at that time, I mean, obviously with farming, you know, the farming industry being not what it is today, but perhaps they knew a lot then, it was grown in an area that really did not have a means for irrigation.
Well, certainly we know that the Middle East is arid, but the development of hydrology and hydraulic technology has been going on since the very beginning, and the Romans had invented various new means of hydrology. The Persians invented some, as well as the Arabs, and so there are the tapping into aquifers throughout the Mediterranean. That was one of the great achievement of the Arab agricultural revolution of the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries was creating this vibrant agriculture in Spain, in Sicily, in North Africa, and the Middle East as well.
Hmm.
And so these kinds of plants were able to be grown much better. Wheat was grown, barley was grown, cabbage became sort of this central vegetable, but nevertheless, the beans and the legumes really took center stage for much of the cuisine of these areas.
Right. Well, and then we know that, you know, they of course made their way to the New World, the Americas, and to have a very important place in the diet. And what about taking you away from the Mediterranean area, the Middle East? What about I had read something where there was evidence that they made their way into Britain quite early. And
are you talking about the old world beans or the new?
The old world beans.
Yeah, it's very hard to kind of pinpoint. In terms of how we know that the center of origin of many of the legumes is probably Central Asia or the Middle East. And once they began moving because people moved. And so as people move, they bring with them seeds to create new forms of agriculture. So I'm certainly it arrived in Britain, but I would doubt if it arrived before the time of Christ. I would imagine it came afterwards. But we don't have real documentary evidence.
Yeah. Now, I had seen something written about the 11th century, so indeed, you're right. It was, yeah, you know, it was quite late. Yeah,
it would be much later, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they are, you said people would move, and an easy thing to bring with you to plant would be beans. I mean, you know,
yeah, and then
beans,
you had to take into factor the climate that you're trying to grow these things in, too. So not all plants make it when they're transported. But, for instance, when the New World bean moved to the Old World, and its first landing was in Spain because Columbus came back and landed in Spain with what he had found. And in his diary, which he's writing in 1492, he arrives in the New World in October, discovers the island, the name of which I'm forgetting at the moment. And about a month later, he's in Cuba, where he describes, and in the diary he uses the word fabas, which is the Spanish word for fava bean.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes these fabas as, quote, different than ours. So what he's discovered, of course, is the bean, the green bean, and or perhaps the black-eyed pea or cowpea. And these are beans that were brought back, you know, after he returned from his first voyage. And then we hear about it by the middle of the 16th century being grown in various places in Italy and Greece and Turkey. So it spread quickly.
All right. Well, they are, as you mentioned earlier, a very versatile food for cooks, as you say, you know, these new dishes, these new foods that were created with them over the millennia, as I mentioned earlier. And very versatile, and you just mentioned adaptable to new climates, new places as people took them with them. It's no wonder that they have stayed around for a long time, and now taking on center stage and a new, very important role in our agriculture today. And I look forward to finding out more about that as well. Clifford, as always, you are a font of knowledge, and I'm glad that to be able to call on you to give us information about some of these ancient medieval Mediterranean foods. And
well, it's been a pleasure.
Certainly pulses, beans. It's something that I think people don't really give a lot of thought of, even though, you know, these, as I say, the food blogs I mentioned at the top of the show, lentil salad, I mean, Patricia Wells' lentil salad, once again, as you know, has been rocking the food blogs and food writings online, and you know, hummus has become such a major industry, and chickpea soup and beans. People are embracing beans like never before, and good reason for it. And I guess it's in our blood, as they say. So, Clifford, thanks so much for sharing your knowledge. And to my listeners, stay tuned, because we're going to learn all about pulses in today's diet and today's agriculture and the importance there. Clifford Wright, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
Hi, I'm back on A Taste of the Past, and we've been talking about pulses. That is, the edible seeds, the dried edible seeds of legumes, beans, lentils, peas, you name it, chickpeas, cowpeas, black-eyed peas, all kinds of wonderful ingredients that go into terrific dishes. And today, more than ever, it seems that these beans, these legumes, these pulses are making their way into our diet and our culinary repertoire. I mean, there's no better proof than the hummus industry, which is grown from a $5 million industry in the mid-90s to now a $350 million industry and growing. Just amazing. And it's a good thing, according to the USA pulse industry. Today I have with me Tim McGreevy, and Tim is the CEO of the USA Dried Pea and Lentil Council, the American Pulse Association, and he's also a pulse farmer, so he has firsthand know-how about all of this. Tim, are you there with us?
I certainly am.
Hi, welcome to the show, Tim, and I know that you have had your calendar filled with all kinds of events this year, being the UN celebration, the UN International Year of the Pulse, or the Pulse, what is it, the International Pulse Year?
International Year of Pulses.
Of Pulses, thank you. I was getting it all turned around.
That's right.
Let's start there. What in the world inspired the UN to create a year of education and celebrations of pulses?
Well, pulse crops are defined as beans, dry beans, peas, lentils, and chickpeas. And they're a subclass of a larger legume family, which also includes soybeans and alfalfa. But pulses are a low oil seed. Peanuts and soybeans are very high in oil, actually oil seed crops. And pulses are just the dry form, peas, lentils, chickpeas, and dry beans, and are called pulses. Actually, the term pulse is kind of an interesting history behind that term. The word pulse is actually from the Latin root of that word, pulse, which actually means a thick soup or pottage. And so it has a long-standing history, culturally, as these crops having a huge impact on food security around the world. So the United Nations designated 2016 as the International Year of Pulses because of the role these crops play in food security around the world. They are the lowest cost vegetable protein that you can obtain. They are also the lowest cost dietary fiber that you can consume in your diet. And they have the added bonus of being a sustainable crop. And what I mean by that is they actually fix nitrogen from the air and put it down into their root systems to produce a productive crop. And as a farmer, this is a huge benefit because I don't have to put on any synthetic nitrogen fertilizers in order to grow this crop. It's actually pulling nitrogen from the air and fixing it in the ground. It actually helps my following cereal grain crop, generally wheat or barley, to actually produce a better crop. So it's great for a great nutritious crop. It's good for your health. It's also a sustainable crop, and it's affordable. So the United Nations decided to recognize these crops because of its importance to food security around the world. And as our population grows, you know, we're estimated to be at 9 billion people by the year 2050, you know, an additional 2.5 billion people, we have to come up with ways, right, to produce nutritious foods that are good for your health and sustainable, and pulse crops are going to play a huge part of providing food security around the world by the year 2050.
Wow. a lot of information, spoken like a good representative of the council, I must say, and a very important council to boot. Now, this is an international, the UN, of course, you know, has declared an international year
right.
of the pulses. But tell me about America's pulse industry and how large does that play in, and as you talked about, the future of our food, the food security, you know, feeding the world.
Well, the really great news is a lot of our pulse crops that are grown in the United States are currently exported, and it depends on the crop. But, for example, lentils, which is grown here in the United States, we export probably about 70% of all the lentils we produce in this country. We export about 65% of all the dry peas that we produce in the country. Chickpeas is a little bit different because chickpeas, because of the advent of hummus and the skyrocketing market demand for hummus that we've seen in the past 10 years, we only export about 50% of our crop goes overseas, and 50% has been staying here to manage this market. Dry beans, it's a little bit similar. We consume about 50%, export about 50% of the dry beans grown in this country. So in terms of acreage, overall, we raise about 3.5 million acres of pulse crops in the United States. We are currently grown in about 23 different states in the Union, clear from the Texas Panhandle to a heavy concentration along the northern tier up against the Canadian border, where the majority of the pulse crops are grown in Washington, Idaho, Montana, North Dakota, Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin, large pulse-producing regions.
Now, the American Pulse, or the council, the USA Council, do you have specifics of who you represent? I mean, are they these organic? Do they have to, they say, you know, no fertilizers because they do fix their own nitrogen? Or what? How is that group put together?
So there's a couple of different organizations. The USA Dry Pea and Lentil Council represents all the farmers, processors, exporters, and trade members in the United States, and they represent peas, lentils, and chickpeas. The American Pulse Association actually is a combination of all the pulse crops. So we also represent dry bean producers, exporters, traders, and food manufacturers from farm to fork. So the American Pulse Association is the overall, you know, umbrella of national organizations that represents the entire pulse industry from farm to fork. And our primary funding is actually coming from the growers themselves in their grower checkoffs to help us out with research and promotion.
Well, tell me a little bit about it, since you are, or you have grown pulses. Are you currently have a farm with pulses grown? Now, for a long time, these were used as a rotation crop.
Right.
And now suddenly they're a standard crop? Not suddenly.
Well, they've become an important part of my crop rotation, both from a soil health point of view, but also from an economic point of view, from my on my farm, and of course, all the farmers that I represent. We've had a pretty significant downturn in cereal grain prices here over the past 6 months, and interestingly enough, the pulse pricing has been able to stay fairly steady. And in some cases, depending on the pulse, lentils, for example, have really skyrocketed due to a shortage. But what we're seeing is, in my tenure as the CEO of the USA Dry Pea and Lentil Council, in the year 2000, we were producing less than 400,000 metric tons of peas, lentils, and chickpeas in the United States. Today, we are producing a little over 1.2 million metric tons, basically tripled our production in that period of years over the past 15 years. And because of the strong demand for vegetable protein around the world and including an increasing demand here in the U.S., we've actually seen our prices increase. And that's a little counterintuitive. You've had any kind of ag economist classes, but we've had this tripling of production, but yet we've had an increasing in our price levels because of the strong demand.
Well, you know, so if you're not using them as a rotation crop, and obviously they're a cash crop at this point, it looks to me. But
sure.
How does that aid in sustainability?
Well, what's great about these crops as a farmer is they break weed and disease cycles as well as actually putting nitrogen back into the soil for my following cereal grain crop. So, you know, weeds is always a huge issue, and disease is a big issue in every crop. So if you were to just plant, you know, nothing but peas every single year on the same piece of ground, you would run into all kinds of disease problems. It's just how it works, right? It's about biodiversity and having good soil health. Well, the same if you're just planting wheat on wheat on wheat on wheat. You know, it's great to have these crops in your rotation because it's terrific for your soil health. And at the same time, it gives, because you're not having to put on heavy loads of nitrogen fertilizer and they're actually putting nitrogen back into the soil, it actually reduces the level that you have to put on of nitrogen fertilizer for that following cereal grain crop, which makes them really one of the most sustainable and lowest carbon footprint crops that you can grow. On top of that, as a farmer, this year we had really dry conditions out in eastern Washington, where my farm is, just north of Pullman, Washington, and we had super dry conditions. And the good news is that these crops are very low water use crops as well. So very important as we move into an era, really, where water could actually be our most limiting resource, to have a crop that is low water use but yet still yields a high level of nutrient-dense foods is going to be very important to the future of agriculture and the future of food production here in the United States and around the world.
Well, certainly it is an important crop for us to realize and support. So tell me about the council. Tell me about some of the work that the council does. I would imagine you're involved in education for farmers. Is that the primary business of the council?
Well, it's certainly a huge component of what we do. We really have four major missions the American Pulse Association and the USA Dry Peanut Lentil Council. We fund research on these crops, both agronomic functionality and end-use research of how to use our crops in different forms of food. So that's a big component of how our checkoff dollars are used. The second component that we really spend a lot of money on is trying to develop markets, provide technical seminars to food manufacturers and chefs on how to use these crops in a creative and innovative ways. What's beautiful about pulse crops, they are so versatile. So we recently had a launch event in New York City, and we hired someone to make green pea ice cream, and it was really good. So, and it had, I mean, get this, right? You're eating green pea ice cream, and you're getting a high level of protein and dietary fiber in that ice cream. And, you know, it does have some sugar in it, too. It did did taste terrific, but it was a great product. And a lot of people just don't think of pulses. They think of, you know, split pea soup or chili, you know, with beans and lentils or chickpeas in it. And those are, of course, terrific products. But it's the new uses that are coming on board right now that are really so exciting for us. So market development is a huge component internationally and domestically. And then policy development, as well, to make sure that our farmers have risk management tools like crop insurance and things like that that are important to raising this crop across the United States. And then finally, just membership development, educating our growers about the importance of pulse crops and how to raise them properly to meet a growing demand.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that you have a lot of very eager people who want to grow these crops because they seem like a very valuable crop, and also, as you say, the sustainability portion of it. And it seems to me not that, far from me to say not a difficult crop to grow, but has fewer problems than some of the other crops that farmers do encounter.
Well, it's like anything that you grow, right? There's a learning curve of how to raise them properly and make sure that they're seeded correctly, and you want to get maximum nitrogen nodulation on the roots, so you get maximum, nitrogen fixation. And so there's a rhizobium that you put on that on the seed to make sure that it kick-starts that bacterial process that, creates that nitrogen fixation process. Harvesting these crops is depending on the crop, can be a challenge a little bit because they grow fairly short to the ground. And so the harvesters have to, be pretty low to the ground, and you don't want to pick up rocks and things like that. But, farmers are just some of the best people in the world, and they're very innovative, and they figure out how to mitigate all of that and get it in the combine and eventually into a bag so people can eat it and consume it.
Well, it's just fascinating to me, and as somebody who does enjoy all kinds of pulses and legumes, and I love exploring new recipes. We were saying that hummus and falafel were new use foods for the new world, but now green pea ice cream. Well, we're going off on a whole other direction. So that's great.
Yeah, exactly. we had a chef that we've been working with at the Culinary Institute, and we had a whole group of food influence and bloggers at the end of January get together at the Napa facility in the Culinary Institute. And the chef, he took the chickpea water that had been cooked chickpea water, and he poured it into a bowl, and he put a wire whisk to it just like he was doing whipping cream, and he whipped it into a foam that you would not believe. It was tremendously tasty, and then he combined it with chocolate and made a chocolate mousse out of it.
Huh.
And that's the chickpea water, okay? That's not even the chickpeas itself. That's just the water, so we're not wasting anything. He was fun when he gave this presentation, because he said, you don't have to waste anything. You want to save the water, you want to eat the chickpeas, and you can make this terrific chocolate mousse out of the chickpea rinse water.
That's amazing. So, yeah. Well, and that is such, and that's
we can do with these crops.
Right, and not no waste is a very hot topic also in today's culinary world, looking to the future. Well, pulses have been around, as we heard from the historian at the top of the show, they've been around for more than 13,000 years. So looking forward to 2050 to feed the world is not that far of a stretch, really, when you think of it. And it certainly is a good education for all of us to include these in our diet. And I wish the very best to you and your group for, especially during this year, but all the years to come, in continuing the education and the growth of this industry. It's been an education for me, for sure. Thank you, Tim McGreevy.
Absolutely. We want to encourage everyone to take the Pulse Pledge. Go to pulsepledge.com and get some simple recipes of how to use these crops. It's really great.
Great idea. All right. Well, thank you for joining me, and thank you for listening. Again, this has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.